DG Geeks, episode 77, special report from Phoenix Comic Con. Hello and welcome to another episode of TG Geeks webcast, where Ben and Keith, the two gay geeks, talk about all aspects of geekdom and nerdery. Sci-fi, comics, film, horror, genre, you name it, we talk about it. I'm Keith Lane, and we're coming to you from the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Phoenix, Arizona, across the street from the Phoenix Convention Center in lovely Phoenix, Arizona.
And I'm Ben Ragington, also coming to you from Ditto, Phoenix, Arizona.
And we're trying to do this without a script.
Yeah, we don't have a script.
And I don't have a clue what I'm saying. We just finished a really great interview.
No, it was awesome.
And we're going to have that interview for you. We just finished with the world premiere of Occupants, the movie. And we sat down with Russ Emanuel, the director, and Julia Camara. She's going to kill me for that, who is the writer, and also Eric Kask, who was associate producer, and he's also the
editor for the comic book spinoff.
Exactly. And we got their feelings on film has...
Chuck Tomasi.
And Chuck Tomasi.
Chuck Tomasi, that guy from that Technorama thing. He was a part of this little shindig.
He sat down with us, and we sat down here in the hotel, and we're going to play that interview for you right now. And greetings from Phoenix Comic Con. This time we have several guests sitting in our hotel room. And
that sounds so kinky.
Yeah, it does, actually. Yes, thanks, Chuck. We have Chuck Tomasi from Technorama.
Hello!
Mr. Technorama himself.
And guesting on our show for once.
Yes, and we have also Julie Camara. She is the writer of Occupants, the movie. We have Russ Emanuel, who is the director of Occupants, the movie. And we have Eric Kask, a producer. And you're also the editor for the comic book tie-in, correct?
Correct, and I also did behind-the-scenes camera work for
cool.
He also directed the film.
He also directed. I see.
Yeah.
He directed the director.
He directed the director. Who directs the director?
Yes. So we are here half an hour?
An hour after the screening.
An hour after the world premiere of Occupants the film.
How does that sound when you hear world premiere?
It sounds great.
It was a surreal
experience, especially here at the Phoenix Comic Con. It was incredible.
Yeah, I was pleased with the crowd. It was a pretty nice crowd.
There
was only a couple of people in there whenever I sat down, and then when the movie was over and they brought the lights up, I looked back.
Look at all these people that came in.
Yeah, people started coming in. I've noticed that.
Cool.
And the good thing is they stayed.
Yeah,
and that's what I liked about it. You know,
they're very important.
To see it.
Very important thing. Yes.
Yeah. Now you've had actual more like private screenings.
Yes.
With other people as far as showing the movie, this was the first public one. How did you gauge their reactions?
Oh, it was great. I mean, people were laughing at the right moments. People were gasping at the right moments. There's this one scene in the film where, I look forward to that gasping reaction.
That be scene 69?
Yes, it is scene 69.
So we can talk about this now.
Infamous.
We can talk about this now. We didn't want to talk about it earlier because the premiere had not taken place yet, but we can completely talk about this now.
Yes.
That is one incredibly powerful scene where Annie hits Annie.
Yes.
And it's not masochistic.
Nope. Mm-hmm.
Not in the slightest bit. There's something rather sadistic about it.
Yeah, and what I like is, it took a group effort to make that scene happen. But I was thinking right before we shot, Parallel Annie, won't you look at the camera?
Right.
Won't you own that scene? And she knew that kitchen inside out. This was her moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's what brought up the freak factor.
Talking about Brianna, the actress in the third person, you said, Parallel Annie, did you address Brianna when you were directing her? Did you refer to her in those terms to help her with her character.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. As she was getting her... You see, we first filmed her, for anybody listening, we filmed her for the first 7 days as Real Annie. And Real Annie has blonde hair. Natural blonde hair. So Brianna has natural blonde hair. Now, she has to transition to Parallel Annie, who has brunette hair. And that took about 5 hours, basically, with the dye job and everything. So during the time when the dye was setting in, during lunch, I sat down with her. And I had a extensive character breakdown, her backstory, Parallel Annie's backstory versus Real Annie's backstory.
Ooh, wow.
And I told her, this is what I think happened and the reason why you turned out differently from your counterpart.
Just a little differently.
Just a little.
Just a tiny bit. Is this anything that we might learn more about in either the comic book tie-in or possibly... when you do get a distributor, and this might be like some sort of back, you know, behind the scenes footage.
Well, I meant,
or in a sequel.
No, that would be a sequel? Julia. That would
sequel.
Be a,
yeah, let's
a Julia question.
Let's do the
let's
sequel.
Let's do the sequel.
I would love to do a sequel. Yes.
And
yeah,
I'm guessing,
me too.
And I'm guessing you already have an idea.
Yes. Yes. I have a vague idea that could be fleshed out very quickly.
Which we sort of came up. We kind of talked about it during a previous trip to Arizona.
Yeah. Ah.
Where it took what we were together for what 12 hours total. So yeah. During those 12 hours, we started talking about a sequel.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of bonding and. Rainstorms and
rainstorms and lightning. Yeah,
oh,
it was
wow.
a very
you're coming
great
through
experience.
Monsoon season, huh?
Yeah.
That was in July or August or something.
That was parallel Arizona.
October.
Parallel
it
Arizona.
Was October, wasn't
really?
It?
Really? Wow.
You see, yeah. they were going through Pueblo Caliente. That's a joke. Exactly. We will share that with you some other time.
You see, as we were crossing the border from California to Arizona, there was a glitch.
Ah,
and then we glitched
I
to Parallel
see.
Arizona, and suddenly everything was turned upside down.
Parallel
yeah.
Arizona.
Oh, wow.
But I got nothing.
But there is definitely a backstory to the real versus the parallel couple.
Oh, cool.
Which is not in the film, of course. But,
right.
You know, in order to make the acting more credible, you know, I wanted to give them that background to
right.
kind of make them understand why their characters turn out the way they did. And, of course, as I was explaining before, I had them bond together.
Right.
You know, just meet up for coffee, just find out each other's mannerisms. You know, otherwise, how are you going to believe them
right.
to be a real couple?
Yeah, we have another director friend that lives in San Diego that he has regular meetings with the whole cast and the people that are supposed to be married. They have to sit together and they have to pretend like they're married for these meetings and all that kind of stuff. So that's really cool to hear that other people are doing that as well. So it's kind of a method.
It's very method. And we purposely rented. We rented the place where we shot the film.
The haunted house.
The haunted house, yes. but it's a very beautiful haunted house. But we purposely rented the place one extra day before. And that one day before was for preparation, not only for the production designer, Tatiana Kolonoff, to set up, bring in her palette or... whatever
right.
you want to call it, you know, the paintings, props, and whatnot, but also for the actors so that they can get to gauge the, the rooms itself so that they can understand where they're, where they're living, you know. So they had to know, okay, I could, in the script, it says kitchen or living room or... you know, the other rooms, but it's just in a script and they're like, okay, so there's an interior kitchen scene, but I wanted them to actually see and understand the interior kitchen scene.
Right.
And so I took him, throughout the house on the day before we started shooting.
Oh, cool.
And I also, we sat down and just went over the script.
Right.
And then
How much rehearsal time did you give them? Because, as I was watching it again tonight, I've noticed, especially at the beginning of the film where we see Annie and Neil is, you know, Annie's given the whole thing about this is what we're going to be doing, whatever. And I'm watching their interaction, and I really felt like I was watching a real married couple that were doing something for YouTube. So it felt so natural, not just the fact that they were comfortable with each other, but just the beats in the way that they spoke.
Yeah,
you know, because he was like Keith and I. I mean, we've been together for nearly 20 years, so we have this this synchronicity in the way that we speak with each other and around other people, and I caught that with them.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of wondering, was there a lot of extensive rehearsal time, and how much of it was really scripted versus how much of it was kind of vamped?
Well, I'll tell you this: we cast Brianna on September 19th. And we started shooting on September
24th. Oh, so, Lord. Oh, my gosh.
So in terms of prep, there wasn't quite
none.
A lot. Yes, but there was a weekend before.
A weekend.
And that weekend, I said, you guys have to get together. You guys have to.
Go just, in the woods.
Well.
What?
Not like that. Yeah. But they.
Yeah, please don't start that rumor.
That's a different movie.
Right. We will be talking to Brianna tomorrow, hopefully. Yeah.
Well, they have their respective spouses, you know, in real life.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, I mean, as for actors, you know, it's about listening to each other.
Exactly.
Right. And so that's, I just wanted them just to talk it over, you know, to gauge each other.
Right. Right.
And yeah. I'm going to take credit on their beautiful rapport because I've been married for a very, very long time, although I'm very young. I have been married for about 13 years.
Wow.
So I did base a lot of Neil and Annie's interaction on, you know, my real life marriage. If anything, the more I watch this movie, the more I feel like, yes, Neil is definitely my husband. Like, as far as...
parallel Neil or real Neil?
Well, yeah, it's funny because then people ask me that. Like, no, not parallel Neil. Original Neil.
He deserved what he got in the end.
Original Neil and Tim, my real life husband, they're very similar. Like I definitely gave him that jokey, you know, voice because that's Tim. Like if he can, you know, find a joke in any everyday conversation we're having, he will find it. And we've been together so long that I anticipate his jokes. And sometimes he hates me because he doesn't get to do the joke because I know the joke's coming. I see it miles away.
Trust me, I live with that.
Right?
Yeah, we know.
It's like, I can't pull anything over on him every once in a while.
Once in a while,
like,
you do.
Yes!
I know, it's like arms raised in victory. But yeah, when you're together like that, you can anticipate each other's gags.
Yeah, yeah. Like you get their humor and you know it's coming. Like
right,
I sometimes
right.
do a Tim joke before Tim can do it. So,
yeah.
And he doesn't
yeah,
like it.
You get that.
Yeah.
Well, no, it is true. It started with her dialogue. I mean, I mean, her dialogue, Julia's dialogue, was very necessary for the actors. And the actors, they made it their own. They melded it, I guess, into their performance. But yeah, it's definitely her dialogue.
Did you write this more as, was it a story that you developed into a screenplay, or did you write it as a screenplay, or how did that happen so that it kind of came together and you then had actual dialogue for them to put on the screen?
Well, it was always a screenplay before it was anything else.
Okay.
I just wanted to do something like, all right, let's put two people in the house. And I gave her a very similar job to my real life job. You know, I put her in a universe that I'm very comfortable with. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know about filmmaking. She could be a filmmaker.
Right.
And it would make sense that she would be videotaping herself if she's a filmmaker.
Right.
But it was always meant for the screen. It developed like that. No, there's something that I want to talk about, but I don't know. Can I give away plot points?
It's been premiered.
Go for it.
Well, I mean, it's up to Russ because he's the director, and
I know.
It needs to probably go out there.
Maybe
a little bit.
There's something that I won't mention what it is.
Well, I'll tell you this. This is spoiler alert for anybody listening because there
spoiler
is going
alert.
To be an encore screening of the film
right,
on
right.
Sunday at the Phoenix Comic Con. I guess same room, 102A, at noon or 12:30. But there will be a second screening of this feature film.
Congratulations.
But that
Yay.
Said, spoiler alert, so go ahead.
Spoiler alert. The whole idea behind Parallel Neil drugging Parallel Annie that was kind of ripped from the headlines. That was a story that I read, I don't know how long ago, some guy drugged his girlfriend to make her miscarry.
Ooh,
and,
harsh.
And then I think she was able to prove it and brought up charges, and hopefully he's
in
jail
somewhere.
And Janelle's
going, this is good stuff. I got to get
Wait,
this.
I know. But honestly, I'm like, this is fascinating.
You can't make this stuff up.
You really
Julia,
can.
Wasn't that your first husband?
Oh,
what? Whoa, what did I say?
Wow.
I said spoiler alert.
Yeah, there we go. That's a big spoiler.
That fixes everything, Ross.
Right.
There's spoilers and then there's legalities.
Yeah. We could fix this in post.
Yes, we can.
Exactly. This one's not autobiographical. No.
From a production standpoint, this is an occupational hazard I have, having put stories to video back and editing them back together. How challenging was it to take Julia's screenplay, deconstruct it to film, you know, parts 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and then go back and film 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, and put that all back together?
Yeah.
Because you had to get all of House in this configuration filmed, and then with the actors blonde and bearded, and then go back and film all the rest, and then put it all together coherently.
Yeah, and maintain a sense of continuity.
Well, there's our first assistant director, Clifford Brakefield, was very instrumental in making that happen, and so was our script supervisor, Alexandria Sanders.
Oh, cool.
And basically, we hired them a couple weeks before we started shooting, so we actually had a lot of prep time, and then we deconstructed the script. Scene by scene by scene.
Yeah, you'd have to have like every storyboard frame color coded and go do all the green ones today.
Yes, and also our director of photography and editor, Emil Harris. He was very instrumental in doing that.
Wow.
You know, I'm giving a shout out to the crew, but
it really
Nina
is.
Minnelli, costume, Alicia
Kudos
by
them.
Yeah, because one of my favorite moments is when Evil Annie is in regular Annie's universe and she's like trashing the house.
Yes.
And we've seen the result already.
Right.
And that's now we're seeing the cause.
That's where my brain kind of went.
I went,
that
wow.
The camera work and the editing on this is superb because they were out of order.
Yes. I have a funny anecdote again.
Please.
This is what we live for.
Please, we love this.
Well,
by the way, she's been nicknamed Darth Annie.
Yes,
Darth Annie.
By USC, you know, screen.
We had a screen.
At a USC screening, one of the audience members nicknamed her Darth Annie.
Yes, we had a screening at my alma mater,
the
University of Southern California. Yeah, at the George
Lucas
Building.
Yeah.
In fact, it was a theater seated 200 people. We had about 180 people show up, so it was
nice.
Pretty full. And it was a theater that George Lucas himself designed. And again, this was at my alma mater at the USC Cinematic School of Arts. So
I did not go to USC. I'm sorry.
So you
I
weren't invited?
USC. No, I went to the screening.
Oh, good. Good.
I went to a different film school. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Okay, so your anecdote. Your anecdote.
Your anecdote.
My anecdote, my Darth anecdote, is our unit production manager. Her name is Jennifer Durst. She doubled for Darth Annie, I guess, if you will, during that scene that you were mentioning where, you know, she trashes the place. So we had to have a hand double. And that's the hand double that touches Annie's belly. Because otherwise, how could we do that? It's not possible.
I kind of wondered.
So we got...
I really didn't consider that. I figured it was just a hand double.
Okay, well, we were looking at different hand models. And her, Jennifer's hands...
Let me see your hand.
Yes. Her hands, it was perfectly similar.
There's nothing silly
similar.
About that. There's nothing silly about that at all. In fact, a lot of big-name studios, whenever they need that kind of double work, they're always looking for some kind of physical similarity.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Now, what is funny, though, is remember I was several days into the shoot already. So, you know, she did her job, right? And she did a great job. I said, okay, great job, Jen. Nice hand job.
Oh!
And then everybody started doing this as you were doing, and I'm going, what? What? And then I'm going,
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. We can fix
you
it
say
in post.
Something
because
and like,
I was actually very being very sincere. She did a very good hand job.
Never mind the yellow stuff on the hand.
Yeah. Oh, don't give away any plot.
Too far, you guys.
It was paint.
Yes, remember, it's gender neutral.
Well, Jennifer actually did, little plug for Jennifer. She actually does a show where a lot of the show is stuff like that, right?
She does
the,
do a show.
The web series
yes.
that yeah. she does, she is, does is exactly the kind of uncomfortable stuff we're talking about right now, right?
Yes. Like hand jobs and stuff?
Well, it's called, it's called, and I guess this is going to be not a PC show, but it's called the Vagina Diaries.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Oh,
nice.
That's okay. We can
I call it the V Diaries. Vagina.
There we go. So I want to ask, since Eric's just kind of been sitting over here kind of listening to all of this, I want to ask about the comic book tie-in. So do you want to tell us about that and where Absolutely. You are with that, what's going on, how that kind of came about? I know Russ has already alluded to that in several of the interviews we've done, et cetera.
And what kind of content can we look forward
exactly.
in terms of that?
So the comic book itself, coming from a producer standpoint, I was looking at ways that we could promote the film better. So it is very much sort of the classic movie tie-in book. It's meant to promote the movie because we've been hitting a lot of comic conventions, expos, things like that. That's where we're doing really well. And I think that's because we're a genre film. And so we're
no,
doing...
I it never dawned on me.
Never.
I never got that. No.
Well, it's interesting. So we've been doing very well with the comic conventions, and we got some offers right off the bat after our very first the Comic and Media Expo, which was the first public event that we had before the film was ready to be shown. And they had a sister event that's called TayoCon, which is actually a bigger event than Comic and Media Expo, even though it's at the same venue. It's an anime convention. So we were kind of invited to participate, and we wanted to try to figure out, well, what's a good way that we could tie in to that audience? And because we're not an anime movie or anything like that. And immediately I thought, well, maybe we could do kind of like a manga style comic book. Maybe that would tie us in, that we could go to this event, because I knew the it's a good event. And it started there. And then as we kind of were fleshing it out more, and we started to realize we were getting more interest in other sci-fi events, comic conventions, it kind of morphed into more of a mainline comic book. Mm-hmm. Because also that was part of the artist that we ended up with. Because
I was going to ask, because who did you get contracted to actually do the artwork for that?
Dave Beatty, who is a has a background in Marvel and DC comics, not in manga style comics. Although we told them that we kind of were coming from that angle. He's a traditional comic book artist. At least that's the stuff he's known for. So he did actually do an independent book called Bushy Tales, which is very, very manga inspired. That's his creation. So he does have that background. So he really was a perfect fit to fit those both worlds. And now being like at Phoenix Comic Con, this is a very mainstream book in terms of, I think, would fit in very well with any other book that you would see here, other than the fact that it's not a superhero book, which I think actually is good for us because now we're not competing with everybody else because right. everybody else is doing superhero books.
You're doing something completely
different.
We're
doing something completely different. Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
As a shout out to Dave Beatty, Dave, he's at table 1300.
1300, yes.
1300, and he's at this convention for the next several days.
Yep. And we should mention that our letterer, Al Sparrow, he's actually there now. It's Thursday night, and he's there now. He'll be there Friday as well because Dave can't get out here until Saturday, and he's manning the fort, and he is our letterer on okay. the book as well, and cool. he's available as well.
So So in terms of content, when people get this comic, now this is going to be a series of issues, or so far is it just going to be a one shot?
It's a one-shot, specifically. That's the way I actually pitched it to Russell. I introduced him to that term. He wasn't yes. familiar with what a one-shot was.
It is 24 pages long.
That's
know.
That's like almost like a graphic novel.
So yeah. There's actually a very good example right now as far as what I was thinking myself, and it's something that the big studio did, is where they explained how C-3PO in Star Wars got his red arm.
Right.
They did it through a comic book, a one-shot, which I actually loaned to Russell. It kind of showed him what my idea was. And you can see that great minds think alike, Disney and me. So, you know, that's
there,
that's...
There's a Disney, George Lucas, we're trying to tie down
right.
Star Wars.
So, but yeah, that's exactly what they did. So what's interesting is that, and what I like, we are taking the same approach, honestly, as Disney and Star Wars, which is the everything matters approach.
Right.
So rather than have what you see in Marvel and DC currently, where it's the Marvel Cinematic Universe and it's the Marvel comic book universe, and they're separate. Obviously, they influence each other, and they take plot points for the movies from the comic books as well, but they don't relate to each other. One doesn't impact the other. They're completely different. They're parallel worlds. That's
right.
One way to look at it, is they're parallel worlds. So what happens in, for instance, like I think in Marvel Comics now, Captain America's a bad guy. He's a Hydra agent.
Right.
That's not affecting the movies at all. He's still a great guy. We all know that, right?
Not until 10 years from now.
Not until 10 years from now. That's kind of the way it happens,
yeah.
Right? But what they're doing, interestingly enough, with Disney and what we're doing is that it's in Everything Matters. So the events in the comic book actually do run parallel to the events in the movie.
Mm-hmm. So you can say that it's all canon.
Yeah.
That's exactly the term I would use. Yeah, that's the kind of the idea that we have. So the comic book itself actually has a scene with Annie in it and with Neil in it. They're actually in the book.
And that's tandem with the movie.
Correct.
Well, basically, it's during Acts 1 and 2 of the film itself.
They
do cameo in the comic book, and the minor characters in the film itself become major characters in the comic book.
Right. So this brings up my question then. What kind of content can we look forward to? Because one of the heartbeats of this movie is the fact that now we're getting this crossover. We're having Darth Annie make the transition from her universe over into good Annie's. Are we going to see that kind of event happen, except on a grander scale in the comic book? I mean, what kind of directions are we looking at here?
Well, I think in the comic book, what we're looking to do and what we have done is obviously we've already talked about the potential for the film to have a sequel and that kind of a thing. So that story would be told in the film, right, if we're going to talk about Annie and Neil specifically and as far as progressing their story. What we've done in the comic book is we've opened it up. So we took a very minor character, which is the spokesperson for the Peterson Research Institute. Remember, there's a movie within the movie, and you guys actually saw
the completed version
of that movie within the movie.
That's cool.
I showed it at the Verde Valley Expo. You guys got to see that. We show that at events where we can't show the whole movie, and it's a 20-minute featurette, and it's the whole Peterson Research Institute video, and that's really the bridge. Mm-hmm. That's actually the bridge between the comic and the feature film.
Yeah, I should mention that. Chris Winters, he plays the PRI rep in the film.
Right.
And then we basically assign him as the son of Dr. Alan Peterson.
Okay.
And he's a major character in the
comic
book. He is the major character of the comic book.
And also, you're mentioning the PRI videos, PRI being Peterson Research Institute, which is the company that Robert Picardo's character pretty much runs. Anyway, one of the cases was my friend Timothy Lee Conley.
Right.
And it was the only other case that I assigned to Los Angeles, just like the crisis in the film. So the comic book is titled Case 285 for that very reason. And that's where basically it was fleshed out, where his character, Lee Mitchell, sort of saw kind of like parallel glitches and whatever not. But not to the point where it would give away the film.
Right.
Yeah, because, again, it runs simultaneously with the film. So, again, the film, what happens in the film...
Stays in the film.
Well, it stays in the film, but, you know, before Case 831, which is what the film is, it was just glitches on the TV. What Case 831, the film, did was it took it a step further, and suddenly what was happening just on TV is now happening in real life. Interactive.
Okay, right. I think that's where, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
The 20-minute featurette that you have, is that going to be part of the material that would be released on the DVD?
Yeah.
Okay,
it's
good.
Yes,
absolutely.
You had lots of material.
Oh, there's quite a lot.
I wanted to ask that because, you know, that is the coolest thing. That's why we said, we have got to talk about
that. That was the selling point,
watching
that video. Now, going back to the comic book and the story that you've got there, as I said, you know, with Annie and Neil in this film, the big detail is the fact that they're crossing over. Will not necessarily with Annie and Neil, but with other people, are we going to see that bleed over from one universe into the other? Except, will it be on a bigger scale? And what kind of ramifications are we looking at?
It's definitely spoiler territory, right?
Yes, but I will say yes.
Yeah,
we go out with a bang.
Yeah,
I want one of those portals in my house because I would be sending my cat through to trash their house, yeah. And then he'd come right back.
But you don't want Darth Todd.
Yeah, it's a Darth cat then.
Yeah, you don't want Darth Todd. I mean, Todd's already really a character. I can't imagine what Darth Todd. Darth Todd will burn your house down.
Yes.
After shedding all over the place.
Exactly.
And Todd has a lot of hair.
I mean, look, one reason, and it was Eric Kesk who, Eric Alexander Kesk?
That's correct.
Anyway,
yeah.
Eric here is the one who sold me on the idea of the comic book.
Cool.
And he actually was sort of talking about it when we were shooting the film, I think, back in October 2014.
October. It's always right. October.
Yeah. It's always October, yeah. But I was just like, okay, it's an idea. We can, maybe...
Well,
an interesting
thing about that.
1 year later, we actually started doing it.
Interesting thing about that relates back to the film. And Russell was talking earlier about how he was taking the actors and really trying to get them to know the house and things like that. Well, Russell really knew the house. And that was because we were basically living on set during most of the shoot. I came a little bit later. I think you shot about 3 or 4 days before I showed up. I showed up for Picardo Day.
Picardo
that was the day
as
everyone
we call
showed
it,
up,
which is day four.
I showed up that
for
day.
For some reason, everybody showed up for Picardo Day.
I can't even begin to imagine why.
My husband and child showed up for
Picardo Day. Yeah, why? What's going on? What's up?
I think I had some footage of that too.
Yeah.
So. And because I was doing the behind the scenes shooting at the actual shoot, but the interesting thing about that was, I started staying there as well once I got there, and so there were nights where Russell and I were just up and talking, and so we're just starting to go over ideas, and I'm talking about stuff that's not even related to occupants, because we're also friends, we're personal friends, so I'm pitching stuff to him like I had an idea, that kind of a thing,
right?
So yeah, there was all sorts of things I was throwing at him that weren't even occupants related, and I've definitely tried to pull him more into the comic book stuff, because I would say Russell has an appreciation for comic books, but it's not like you're thing,
it isn't. You had to push me into that that territory, I guess.
What was it that sold you?
That was October 2014. Then in April 2015 we shot the PRI videos, those videos that you saw. And then a couple months later I was thinking, look at all these videos, and then we created this fake Peterson Research Institute site, and I'm going, maybe we could do something that's more viral, more transmedia, if you will, try to get it out there. I'm going, and then I think what sold me was the fact that he's like, we could expand this universe, and we could do things that for budgetary reasons in the feature film we could not do, for instance, explosions and
that's the producer talking, by the way, too. That's because I think about those things.
And exteriors and just you go all out. And then he's the one, is the comic book aficionado. He's the one who knows people like Dave Beatty. So without Eric here, I would not have, talked to, I'm sorry. I would not have talked
it's
to,
the Cracker Jack.
It's the Cracker Jacks. I was eating Cracker Jacks, people. It's delicious, but it gives you a little phlegm. Anyway, so.
They're also fake. They're not in the box, so they're
not real
Cracker Jacks. They're imitation Cracker Jacks, as far as I'm concerned.
We couldn't find the real stuff.
There isn't any real stuff.
We just lost our sponsorship with Cracker Jacks.
I apologize, but it's quite delicious.
I think we lost it a long time ago.
But again, it's Eric here. Eric, again, we met. One of my films called Girl with Gun 10 years ago, it got into the Phoenix Comic Con, and that's how we met. It was a good, 2006, I guess? It was 10 years
ago.
Literally 10 years ago.
Wow.
And then, over the years, we kept in contact. He was on set for my first feature film, PJ.
Which was awesome. That was an awesome day. That was an awesome scene. Day to be there. That was the accident scene.
That
was
the
really
accident
cool.
scene. It's a different film. It was John Hurd, Home Alone dad, and Halle Kate Eisenberg, who was the Pepsi girl, and you go on. Anyway, it was a great experience. I was 29 years old. My first feature film. I had the stellar cast.
Sky's the limit.
No, it was very nerve wracking.
You shouldn't tell people how old you were, because now they're gonna do the math and they're gonna figure out how old you are now.
Yeah, but I did that film in 2019.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to get back to that a little bit later.
Okay, but that's the thing. I mean, it's Eric here who knows these people, and he knows these professionals, so he knows Dave Beatty. And then we had a three-way conversation, because I'm in Los Angeles and they're in Arizona, right?
Correct.
And so at that time when we talked in November 2015, there was actually a time difference. That's the daylight savings time,
right?
So, you know, I had
We don't do daylight savings. So.
No. Yeah. Right, so now, right now it's the same time. But,
yeah, we don't change the clock. So at that point, we were 1 hour ahead of you.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and I know, I remember we had a little confusion there. Like, you mean 9 o'clock our time we talk or 9 o'clock your time? Anyway. But yeah. We talked and, you know,
it's the parallel universe.
It's the parallel universe.
Everyone else is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm sane.
Yeah.
but again, it's Eric here. Eric knows Dave Beatty. Al Sparrow and he's Brian Miller. Right?
Well, Dave brought Al in because they're collaborators, and Dave was the one who brought Al in. They collaborate
on the Red Skirts, which is
pretty. That's kind of neat. That's an unintentional thing, but I just wanted to give him a little plug. But it ties into what's been helpful in our marketing is obviously having Robert Picardo. You've went to a Star Trek convention,
yes,
and things like that, because the Star Trek community is obviously very supportive of their actors, even if they're doing other things.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So what's neat, and this was not planned, it was just because I was looking for different people that I knew were good and trying to get rates and all that kind of stuff and figure this out logistically. And it was really kind of a little happy accident that they're working, you know, Dave and his collaborator Al, they're working on a Star Trek parody called Red Skirts, and then we have a Star Trek actor in our film, and it wasn't planned that way. It's really neat, and I think that we have that more of that connection, and that's going to help the film, I think, in the marketing.
See, now you got to use Robert Picardo to get to Robert Beltran and make Julia's day.
There you go.
Whoa. What were you talking about, Julia?
Well, she just happens to be a big fan of Chakotay.
Well, here is why.
He's here.
I know, and hopefully I will get to meet him. Many, many years ago, Tim and I were dating, and I was not.
Is this your first husband?
See, we're kind of on the whole Voyager thing, and you mentioned Tim. I'm going, Tim Russ? I didn't know.
My first and only husband, Tim Aldridge. We were just, we were first dating, and we would watch, Voyager all the time. Yeah. And it was in syndication. We didn't start dating that long ago. We've been married 13 years together. I don't know.
Kids.
A couple more before that. And so we it sounds like a really lame courtship, but yeah, we would go to his apartment.
Trust me, it's not.
No, it's not.
Heard ours yet.
We would go to his apartment and watch Star Trek Voyager. And at that point, I'm going to have to confess, I wasn't very familiar with the Star Trek franchise at all, but I'm like, a woman is a captain? Like, this is freaking awesome. I want to watch. Let's watch this show again. This show's on again. Let's watch it. Let's do it. So to me that, 11 years later that Robert Picardo ends up, in a film that I wrote,
it was a squee moment.
Right.
Yeah. But that was the selling point, right, Julia, when Howard Nash, the producer, approached you?
Well, actually, when Howard and I first started talking,
yes.
So the part that Picardo plays is a little, information that not a lot of people have. It was originally written for a woman. Because I like to write women where you would assume a man would play that role, right?
Strong women. Yeah.
It's like it's a doctor. He's the mentor. He has all the information. I'm like, all right, this character is going to be played by a woman. And then I start talking to Howard, and I start watching all of Howard's films. And I'm like, oh, look, Howard has worked with Robert Picardo many, many times. Hey, Howard, that role that was originally written for a woman, can we rewrite it for a man? And he's like, yeah, I think we could get Picardo again. And I'm like, let's do it.
That is so cool.
Let's make it happen. I've never before have changed a character from a female to a male. But for Picardo, I would do it again.
That's so cool.
So
that
went from cool. Ellen to Alan.
I can see that.
It'll light up and we're good.
That's great.
Yeah, I think I watched like all of your films that I could get a hold of, even before we met. Like I had seen PJ and...
Chasing the Green?
Actually, I haven't seen Chasing the Green.
Or Nathaya?
I did see Nathaya. Nathaya was great. I'm sorry. I still need to watch Chasing the Green. But have you watched my films, Russ? Okay, here's the truth.
Of course. All of them.
Wow, he says with shifty eyes.
I watched this film noir
You are just so squirming in your chair right now.
Oh, you did come to my screening. Russ
I did
came
come
to my screening.
To your screening.
Yeah. Oh, look at the time.
Oh, look at the time. I think we have to go.
I have to go wash my cat.
No, you guys. Russ came to my screening. Yeah, right before we shot.
It was a very
shot.
Nice. Which one was that? That was
Unsolved. Yeah,
Unsolved.
Film
yeah.
noir. Yeah.
It was a film noir 1947 film, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
I actually directed that because I direct sometimes.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah,
not
like
all
that
the
one.
Time.
I like that one.
I consider myself primarily a writer who sometimes directs, you know, when I'm really passionate about something. Like the next thing I have coming up, I also directed. But it was like highly experimental. We shot that with no script.
So you're
which is funny because people are like, are you crazy? You're a writer. Like you're shooting something with no script. I'm like, yes. Yes, I am because I'm also a filmmaker and I like to experiment.
So you were saying, so you like to direct things you're highly, so you, that you're highly passionate about. So in other words, you weren't very passionate about this.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't give a shit about this.
I didn't think so.
No, all of my scripts are my children.
I love them all equally.
Well, you know, you have favorites. I mean, I only have one kid, but I hear from people
this
that
is
have
not
multiple
helping
children.
Any.
I hear Keep from people digging. That have multiple children that you have favorites. You
well,
know,
I will tell you, Occupants is one of my favorites. I mean, as a film, as a director,
film.
I just love really... something about Occupants for me. I mean, I've directed those other films, but the vibe.
Oh, those
just
other
felt...
films.
Those other films.
No, but they mean
well,
nothing to you.
Well, no. I mean, you know, I had a short film called Girl with Gun. It also got the Phoenix Comic Con and the San Diego Comic Con, and we're actually going to be at the San Diego Comic Con for Occupants.
Oh, cool.
So it was kind of a mini reunion for both the Phoenix Comic Con and. The San Diego Comic Con, but you know, I had a great vibe with that film. I had a great vibe with PJ, and I definitely had a great vibe with Occupants.
Cool. And I've gone on record, you know, and I can say this now that because I was really hedging my bets, or I just didn't want to really gush too much when we had the previous interviews with you. But the reality is, you know, when Keith and I sat down to watch this, I mean, we had to continually stop. Hmm. And you know, pause the film and talk about what we were watching because we were so geeking out
in
all of the details. We loved this movie, and when it was over, I mean, I was like exhausted.
But this is
in all the good ways.
And the interesting thing was when we watched that film, we watched it the night before we interviewed you.
Yes,
so it was like
it was fresh,
very hard for us to not
just
go. You know, off the deep end gushing about it.
And I wrote my review that very night. I was just like so insane over it. I mean, I loved the movie.
Well, I appreciate that. But I will tell you, we put a lot of Easter eggs in there. I mean, a lot. See, if you, there are a lot of nuances. Like when you glitch to the parallel world towards the later part of the film, you could see like in one scene, you see I'm spoiling. Spoiler alert. There's a red gas canister by the front door. But it's very subtle.
Didn't notice that.
Then it disappears, and then that's the that's the foreshadowing visually that she's gonna do something to her.
Oh,
interesting.
Well, I mean,
stuff like that.
You have all the split screens, and you know that's one of the things that I didn't fully anticipate when I wrote the script that you would do all the split screen stuff. Where, you know, sometimes we're watching four different pieces of video at the same time.
You gotta be you gotta be careful with that too, because you don't know where the viewer's eye is going to be.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and if you do something real quick in one frame, you hope they're not looking at the other frames and miss it. Yeah.
But that's the beauty of it though. Like I've watched it, you know, I've personally have watched it like the three times we screened, I think is the three times I've actually watched it all the way through.
Yeah.
My mom and my grandmother watched it at one point in my living room on DVD, and I just, for whatever reason, I couldn't sit through it because it's my family and it was just the two of them. And I was very self-conscious. And Tim's like, why aren't you watching the movie with your family? I'm like, because it's in my head now. You know, it's not
well,
a
no,
very...
I totally understand that. I feel the same way when I watch a film. It's very hard for me to sit through it.
It's actually a little bit better if it's like an impartial audience. Like,
I
the
agree.
Audience
I
today
agree.
Was great. They were
I
gasping
totally agree.
Where they should have been gasping.
Yeah,
they were
totally
laughing
agree.
Where they should be...
Yeah,
and there was someone who was like doing this whole thing where she kept going, oh my God, what's happening now? I can't believe they're doing that. And I'm like, who is this person? I'm going to bring it to all of my screens. You are awesome. There's
they
like
were,
a
they were sitting
commentary.
Right in front of us.
Yeah, there was these three people who were right in front of us, and then, I know they were giggling a lot, and I'm like, okay, maybe, you know, I felt like they weren't taking it too seriously, but then there was scene 69.
Yes, and there was the
and
gasp.
I heard, and yeah. was not just gasp, I actually caught them out of my eye, and they, like, they went,
they flinched.
I mean, their hands went back. You know, they reacted, and I thought, great. Yes. I mean, it's not my movie, and yet I'm like, yeah, because I really want everybody to love this movie.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That scene was very, very interesting in terms of, and from my perspective, being kind of the fly on the wall and looking at everything. That was really an interesting scene to shoot. It really was. And then I got pulled into it outside of what I was actually doing to actually help create the scene, because the issue we had is in the film, it looks like we have cameras all over the place. We only had one camera as far as what was filming the movie. So,
the only
other camera on set at that point was mine. It was the behind nice the scenes job. Camera. Nice so job. The thing was, is that to make that scene work, and it was it, there was a lot of anxiety about what if something gets moved? What if so that yeah, so right. they did not want to touch that camera. The camera could not be touched.
Nope.
So the only way we get around that. Was literally I was standing over Russell's shoulder and he was watching on the monitor because that's what he would do. He would watch on the monitor while the director of photography is operating the camera. So he's watching on the monitor. I just filmed over his shoulder, and that's how we were able to make sure that we had the exact right cadence and everything. And Russell actually pulled out his laptop and had his editing software that he put that into to make sure that scene actually worked. It was really interesting.
And
really,
what was
really
my reaction? What was my reaction?
Oh, he was elated. You know,
I was like yes.
Yep. And it was so cool to watch because even with the software that he had on his laptop. It really looked cool, even just, you know, not fully rendered and everything.
Right.
I was like, that looks awesome. Yeah, you know, that's so works. Neat.
It's a great scene.
And I have to take that credit scene. That I helped make that
yeah,
scene.
Because
I was just like, that was so cool for me. You know?
I would not have moved on if I didn't have 100% confidence that it worked. So, yeah. You know, Eric, thank you for shooting that.
That was awesome. It made me feel really good to be able to, because it was so important. And it was like, hey, I actually helped make that scene
I was
happen.
Getting yeah, nervous so. When... Evil Annie was in the living room or the dining room taking that perspective shot to figure out where did this come from?
Yeah.
I was so afraid she was going to hit the tripod.
but that's okay. But in her world, you know, there is no tripod.
Yeah, in her world, there is no tripod. There's nothing there. So.
Yeah.
Producer mind.
That's how we did that. That was pretty easy, actually.
Well, that's one of the things
but
that...
You're correct, though. I was afraid she would hit the tripod, too.
That to me, you know, as the writer and also a filmmaker, that's one of the scenes that I truly appreciated how Russ staged that particular scene, because I've always envisioned, like, you know, at one point she's going to have to enhance that image to read what's in that prescription bottle. Yeah. And yet every time I watch it, I'm like, it's so brilliant that, you know, that the bottle is right there, you know, and that he puts it in his pocket and that whole, you know, that, yep. just the way that the staging of that scene to me is really exciting. And I don't think it was ever scripted that
it's
way.
It's downright
so.
Creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very creepy. Now, I got a deep geek on something here because
go ahead.
I noticed this.
No spoilers.
Well, oh man, this is going to be
sort of
spoiler alert.
Okay, I'll have to make another note here.
I have to go into spoiler territory here because there's no way that I can get around it. And I noticed this the first time Keith and I watched it, and then I caught it again when we saw it tonight. Now, in terms of the chronology of events, there's a moment where in Annie's office, we see something kind of flash in the background. And I'm trying to. Spoiler.
It's very close to the end. That's why it's like yeah,
right.
That's,
okay.
That's a big spoiler.
it's Neil.
Yes.
And I'm assuming he's on fire.
He
definitely was in pain.
Okay.
We don't know exactly what was going on.
But he looked like he was burning.
Yes. Yeah. He wasn't when we shot him. He was. Not burned at all, nothing. It was the visual effects people that made him look like he was burned.
Because I noticed that a little bit later is when it later
it's
in
a
the
foreshadow. It's a foreshadow of what happens at the very end of the film.
Because remember, so it's more of a technique as opposed to something literally happening in the story. Because if he really was on fire, then it's like, okay, maybe events are not exactly happening in synchronicity. Mm. Maybe time runs a little bit more compressed in one universe as opposed to the other.
Basically, what happened, and correct me if my chronology is wrong, Julia, sure, but he's already been set on fire.
Yeah, he's already been...
Right, because they sent the camera back.
I just spoiled
but
it.
But they sent the camera back. But the camera...
Yeah, spoiler alert.
I know. So we're going very, very spoilerific here, so audience, please forgive me.
And you're making it very difficult for me to edit this tonight.
I know, and I'm really, really sorry, but maybe I should take this off mic, but there was just... it was this story point that's just really, like, been nagging at me in the back of my head about it.
So the interesting thing is, from a writer's perspective, that flash of Neil was always there in the script. The fire portion was actually something that Howard suggested, mm-hmm, so it got put in later. So in my head, it's not those two events are not always connected, because when I first wrote the story, there was a flash of Neo, but we didn't know what was going on with Neo. Like, the last time we saw Neo, he had collapsed after being drugged by Annie. So we don't know if he's dead or alive.
Right.
Like, we don't know if she gave him enough, you know, drugs to kill him or just make him unconscious. And who knows what she's doing? I don't know. In my head, I'm like, she could have been doing it. I would have done a variety of things.
And I will offer a third explanation, which can also tie into some of the stuff that we're doing in the comic book. What if there is a Neil number 3? The whole premise of the comic is these massive multiple parallel universes.
That is true.
And he could have been burning at the same time.
Because we joke about that, Eric number in 1, the, 2, 3.
Actually, I could accept that.
Yeah, we almost brought in actually a third storyline.
Well, it's
which was parallel world number 3.
Which is a very sound idea because it quantum mechanics, you know, and you start going to the of quantum mechanics and you start looking into string theory, you know, for every single decision that a person makes, you know, there's always another decision, and another reality is literally being spun off at every moment. So string theorists are postulating the idea that at every given moment of every day, there's an infinite number of alternate universes that are being spawned at that time. So, I could accept the idea that maybe we're looking at yet another, like an Earth 3 or something.
Well, in the comic book, it is another universe.
That's what I'm saying. And there's probably a Neil and Annie. I was going with the actress's name instead. But there's probably an Annie and a Neil in the main world that we play with in the comic book, which is another parallel world.
So the whole idea of a huge multiverse could actually feature in as a story point in the comic book itself. The idea that, you know, someone says, you know, there's like an infinite number of Earths out there.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Well, look, keep thinking of the featurette. You've seen the featurette and all the different stories all these different things that are going on, this phenomenon.
Some of them, DC, like, was it British America?
Yeah, that's not giving anything away. That's on our cover. That's on the cover of our book, is that it's Big Ben being destroyed, so you know that there's something weird going on.
Well, the
there,
one commonality that I caught on that featurette is this one football team that's the LA Condors. I mean, that was the one commonality that I drew out of all of that.
The LA Condors. In fact, if you listen to the sportscaster, they in the film itself, did you mention?
Yeah, we caught Condors. That on the first. I didn't catch it tonight, but the very first time we saw it, yes, I did hear that, and I felt very rewarded.
So when is the next screening of this
besides the encore?
Besides the encore.
Okay, so the encore, again, for anybody listening, is this Sunday.
Sunday at noon.
At noon, yes.
Right.
At the same room, which I think is 102A.
102A.
West 2A.
He said we might be in 102B, but it's right next door.
Yeah.
So now we're in the parallel 102.
Exactly.
Evil 102.
So then after that,
we're going to be in Miami, the Florida SuperCon.
Okay.
And that's during July 1st through 4th, and we're going to have 3 screenings of the film there.
Cool.
So they say.
And then Phoenix.
And
or
Picardo will be there too.
Oh,
by
cool.
The way.
Yeah. Oh,
Picardo,
that's huge.
But the thing is, we found out about Florida in December.
Right.
We found out about Phoenix only 2 months ago.
Right.
So recently.
Yes.
Yeah, because remember, they hadn't fully.
I'm saying this for the sake of the show.
Oh, yeah. So sorry.
And then we
I'm an idiot.
And then we have a screening in San Diego. Again, we found out a couple of weeks ago that we got into the San Diego Comic Con, which is the, I guess, the grandfather.
One in New York are like the two biggies.
I was very elated when I found out about San Diego. But it turns out
really cool
that they actually accepted the film on April 27th, but I never got the email.
It took
the director to call me, says, "Do you still want to be part of the San Diego Comic?" And I'm like, "What?
April 27th?
I know. I did not get the email. I think it must have gone to the parallel world.
There we go. That's your excuse when you're sticking to it.
Even Andy came in and hit.
That was the day of our USC screening.
I think it was the day before, wasn't it?
So Dark Russ said,
I think I was so busy prepping for the USC screening, or it happened on that day, that I must have misplaced the email. So blame it on human error on my parallel self.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us. We've had Eric Kask, who is the producer of
associate
the film.
Associate producer and editor of the comic book tie-in.
Russ Emanuel, who is the director of Occupants, and Julie Camera, who is the writer. As well as Mr. Technorama, Mr. Chuck Tomasi. And for Keith and Ben, we're signing off.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
101.
Yeah, 101.
Smart Alec.
And that's kind of our second segment, music. And normally we talk about other things, but we'll just say that we've got some other things coming up here.
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Phoenix Comic Con. We're probably going to be releasing several
special interviews while we're here.
Special interviews and special episodes.
Yeah.
So stay tuned.
Yeah.
We're going to have more.
A lot more, I think.
I hope.
Yep.
So thank you for listening, and we will be back with another episode soon.
Very soon.
I bid you peace.
Cheers.